ladies and gentlemen. First case for argument this morning is Z-Chem against Bristol Myers. Mr. Mattyman.
May it please the court. I'd like to call the court's attention at the opening to page 72 of the joint appendix, which was the initial joint status report filed when the case first was commenced in the district court. At page 72, the history of Taxol and the involvement of Z-Chem with that history is spelled out at length, as well as the significance of Bristol-Myers' monopoly power. And as the court will note at the bottom of page, Joint Appendix page 72, the most recent Form 10-K showed that Bristol-Myers in 1999 made $1,481,000,000 from Taxol. The following year, $1,590,000,000.
Help us with the statute of limitations question to know what their net profits were.
Thank you, sir. The next most important thing for the court to consider is the fact that the court's prior ruling in two cases, one is U.S. Gibson, which is a 2003 decision, and the other is the embracement of the Hanover Shoe case out of the Supreme Court of the United States. And that question really resolves itself: has any violative conduct occurred after March of 1999, which would then start the statute of limitations running from that violative conduct? At page 20 of our brief, we place before the court a timeline. And in that timeline, we refer to two sources of authority. The first was the complaint as originally filed, and the second was the proposed and tendered amended complaint, which, as we show in the brief, the court failed to properly exercise discretion and accept the amended complaint.
But let me ask you a question that gets a little more specifically to the statute of limitations point, and I certainly would also like to address the standing issue. But with respect to the statute of limitations, there are basically two kinds of antitrust cases. One kind of antitrust case deals with overcharges, underpayments, monopolistic behavior. And in those cases, it's fairly easy to see that as long as either the cartel or the monopoly is in place, consumers are still paying the overcharge, and it's relatively easy to find acts within the four-year period. Exclusionary conduct, though, is the type of antitrust violation that your complaint alleges. And exclusionary conduct cases are somewhat different, market exclusion cases, if you want to call them that. And as I take it, the district court's theory was once Z-Chem had taken the steps to exclude you from this market, as you would put it, in 1997, that was basically it. And at that point, you knew that you had been injured. So maybe you could address the way we should think about the antitrust statute of limitations in market exclusion cases.
Yes, ma'am. The question is when the thief, if he only commits the one burglary, is he exonerated from his plan to commit further burglaries?
Well, here, hypothetically, suppose Z-Chem in 1997, when the PTO grants the patents and there's the Orange Book listing, just said, okay, we're just not going to do Taxol. We're out of this market. And you were out then, you've stayed out now. Surely in that case, you would agree that the statute had run.
No, ma'am. Because at that point, under Hatch-Waxman, every time an application was made for an abbreviated new drug application under Section 4 of that statute, there was a requirement to describe the patents that would oppose the granting of the application. And every one of those incidents under the Hatch-Waxman Act and its amendments, Bristol-Myers would immediately file a patent infringement case in some jurisdiction, generally in New Jersey. Your Honor undoubtedly recalls the five New Jersey patent cases, which in 2001, the...
No, I understand this. What you're alleging is the kind of rolling patent lawsuit that the Federal Trade Commission described in its July 2002 study. Now, I understand that, but the point is, if you yourselves basically threw in the towel in 1997, it's hard to see. Maybe this spills over into the standing inquiry. Hard to see why you are still suffering an injury.
Your Honor, we never threw in the towel. As the timeline of page 20 shows, and I see my lights up, we were going on in 2000 and 2002. We submitted samples to the FDA for approval. We got approval. We entered into...
And you were manufacturing Taxol elsewhere, right, in foreign markets.
Right.
Right.
And, Your Honor, I'll just lay one question on, Your Honor, on the court. When it's Bristol-Myers' turn at this lectern, I know they will explain to you the one patent infringement case they took to a conclusion. And what they did was they took a grant of exclusivity that was a five-year grant, 1992 to 1997, and they engrafted five additional years on that grant by using a technique exactly as the Federal Trade Commission complained and found bad faith, fraud upon the Patent Office. And then, if Your Honor will notice in the other filings we have here, they exacted a monopoly price, more than $4.50 per milligram. $4.50 per milligram when the generic makers are able to market it at a profit.
How are we supposed to assess your market exclusion, though, when you never filed an ANDA?
Because, Your Honor, when we made the election that we did not have the wherewithal to go to war with Bristol-Myers and when the other generic makers did, but we went into other markets in the world. We went up to Canada, we went up to India, and we became, as we have always been, a source of generic material. It was only in the United States that we were unwilling to take on a $20 billion company that was this aggressive, maintaining its monopoly power.
Let me ask you this. Once Bristol-Myers had secured the 30-month extension after the other companies had filed their ANDAs, is there any way you could have entered the market, or did they just have that exclusivity for the 30 months?
They pyramided it, Your Honor.
But I'm asking a very specific question. Company A comes in, files an ANDA, then Bristol-Myers comes in and files a patent infringement suit, gets the 30 months.
So automatically,
if Company B now comes in with an ANDA, is there any way it can enter the market, or is that 30 months just absolute?
The 30 months is, until it's disposed of, until a patent.
Right, case. Okay. So it would have been a futile act for you to have filed.
No way we could accomplish it. And then, of course, instead of making drugs at a low price, we would be paying lawyers at a high price.
What's wrong with that?
The basic point that goes to any right-thinking company in the position that Zecam was in, as a well-established, scientifically able generic maker, do any other thing than what it's done. It had the right people, it manufactured the material, and it elected to use its assets on positive things rather than litigating. Thank you very much.
I have a question. Has any consumer brought a lawsuit against Bristol-Myers?
As far as I know, I'm aware of, it depends on the definition of consumer. 21 attorneys general on behalf of the states who, in essence, are...
No, I'm asking about consumers.
The lady with breast cancer.
Pardon?
A lady with breast cancer. I'm not aware of any suit...
The actual payors, Blue Cross, Aetna Health, other people who shell out the billions of dollars for Taxol, they have not... Sue Bristol-Myers?
The only case I'm aware of, Your Honor, is the Attorney General's case, and that was a conglomerate.
Don't you think we learned something from the fact that the people who actually pay what you describe as the monopoly prices don't want treble damages?
Well, Your Honor, I have a...
Plaintiff's antitrust bar is usually pretty attracted by treble damages in the quantities you're talking about. Maybe we should draw an inference from that.
I don't know, Your Honor. I know we had the Blue Cross case up in Wisconsin, the Marshfield Clinic case, where that was the issue. I think that case did not zero in on tax, although it hit the high price of drugs generally. The tax law situation, however, was unique because, unlike most of these cases, Bristol didn't do the research. The taxpayers paid $32 million for this research, and one of the original bidders...
I don't think that would have anything to do with the incentives of consumers to seek treble damages if there's a real problem here.
Is this drug normally covered by insurance?
I don't know for a fact, Your Honor. Perhaps Mr. Stark will tell you. I don't know.
Okay.
When it first came out, it was like any other new drug. Insurance have a history of being reluctant or reticent to do it. Some of the dosages that Bristol-Myers sought patents on went from the original 60 milligram and 90 milligram doses, where they sought a patent on a 250 milligram initial dosage on a periodic delivery on the chemotherapy, and that would, of course, made each dose a cost of a little over $1,500.
Wow.
So I don't know what the answer is to that.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Stark.
May it please the Court, the pertinent facts in this case are really very few. Zicam is a putative generic drug manufacturer.
How do we know, actually, what the pertinent facts are? This case was dismissed on the complaint, and the statute of limitations is an affirmative defense. And the district court's view, your view, too, it seems, is that the plaintiff has some obligation to plead facts to negate an affirmative defense. And I would have thought if there was anything well established in federal practice, it is that that's not required. Affirmative defenses need not be anticipated, they need not be pleaded around, and so the only facts that need to be in the complaint about the statute of limitations are zippo, nothing.
Yet, Your Honor, that is in general correct, but it is also
true. It is
true.
Not correct in general. It is correct.
Yes, it is also true, Your Honor, that a plaintiff can plead himself out of court by pleading facts that establish that defense, such as
and
that.
And how did the plaintiff establish a defense here, as opposed to just leaving out things like, had the patent right not been extended, we would have changed our mind 2 years later and filed an ANDA and so on?
The plaintiff here, in this case, affirmatively pled and therefore admitted that in June 1997, it put its intention to file an ANDA on permanent hold. Those are the plaintiff's words of the plaintiff's admission, that it stopped its effort to get on the market at that point in June 1997.
Yes, and things often restart.
The question is, can the plaintiff prove any set of facts consistent with that allegation that would lead to the right to recover? And there are a number of things. If you know about the Orange Book, you know, for example, that one exclusionary act at one point doesn't give you perpetual rights to exclude. There's only a 30-month period, give or take. And obviously, the other statutory provisions are there as well. It also is the case, as I was just discussing with your opponent, that once one company has filed the ANDA, it would really be a waste of money for somebody to come in and file its own once you've gotten that next 30-month period. They can think about it for 25 months and see where things are going. I have very much the same concern Judge Easterbrook has, which is that even granting that they said exactly what they said about 1997, I don't see anything inconsistent with harm from later exclusion, such as the 2000 filings.
Yes, Your Honor. When they plead that they put their intention on permanent hold in 1997, they don't follow that up with any pleading that they had any action.
They don't have to plead anything, right? The way you plead yourself out of court is to put in your pleading something that, if contradicted later, exposes you to a prosecution for perjury. And they haven't done anything like that. They just haven't pleaded something that says and we might have changed our mind 4 years later. But they don't have to. I just don't see what's going on. I also don't understand what this has to do with the period of limitations, because I've always thought of the period of limitations in antitrust as a defendant-specific thing and not a plaintiff-specific thing. The period of limitations depends on exclusionary acts and anti-competitive consequences, not on the plaintiff's behavior. What you're talking about here, that is, that Zicam might never have entered, sounds like a reason why, even though the suit may be timely, they can't establish any damages. But that's a different problem from the statute of limitations.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, what they plead here is that that anti-competitive act allegedly undertaken by Bristol-Myers Squibb precluded them from the market in June 1997. They then attempt, and that is, respectfully, an ordinary exclusion from the market case. They say they're excluded from the market in June 1997. They attempt then to get around the...
Let's suppose Blue Cross brought a lawsuit today. Do you think that would be barred by the statute of limitations?
If Blue Cross brought a case against Bristol-Myers on Taxol?
Yes, brought a suit against Bristol-Myers, against Taxol today, saying that within the last 4 years, Bristol-Myers has taken steps that enabled it to collect an anti-competitive price for Taxol. Barred by the statute of limitations?
No, Your Honor, because in that case, we're then talking about repeated sales to consumers paid for in large measure by the insurer.
Then it seems to me there can't be a statute of limitations problem when Zicam sues, that the real problem, as you see it, is that Zicam can't show it was injured by the conduct, which is different from what is the period of limitations.
Because you would agree that you've had exclusivity, that, you know, obviously your position would be entirely lawfully, but whatever, you have claimed exclusivity over Taxol pursuant to Hatch-Waxman, et cetera, during all of this period of time. So they couldn't enter the market. They've been excluded from the market, right?
They were excluded from the market in June 97.
And they remained excluded from the market, right?
They, in fact, did not enter the market.
But the point is, please, I mean, you filed and you got these 30-month extensions under Hatch-Waxman. You were excluding other generic manufacturers of Taxol from the market. And you have to agree with that. I mean, Bristol-Myers' position, I'm sure, is, and we had every right to do so.
Yes, Your Honor.
But you were excluding them from the market.
Absolutely correct, Your Honor. I just wanted to point out that generic competitors did enter the market in approximately the beginning of 2002, after having successfully litigated against Bristol-Myers Squibb. And to go to Your Honor's earlier point, Zicam could have done, in this case, just what every other competitor, generic competitor, who is seeking to put itself into a position to be an actual competitor does, which is to file an ANDA with or without a Paragraph 4 certification.
But what's the point if everybody else has done it? Why does that say that they are too late for statute of limitations purposes instead of perhaps failing to show that they were sufficiently ready to manufacture Taxol or failing to show that they were damaged very much? I mean, this, after all, is a company that manufactures Taxol all over the world. It would be fairly easy on this record to show that they know how to do it.
Yes, Your Honor. We, in fact, do argue the lack of injury point or lack of ability to show damages, and that was one of our points below and one of our points here as
but
well.
But not a point open to you on the face of the complaint. Right? It may be a perfect response that they can't show damages, but I don't see how one can dismiss a complaint for failure to state a claim on which relief may be granted on the theory that they're going to have trouble showing damages later.
Not
just a completely different kind of problem.
Your Honor, we do not merely argue that they would have trouble showing damages, but that under GRIPPAC, for example, they would not be able to show damages if they cannot show that they were reasonably prepared to enter the market.
Well, and that sounds like a question you're going to have to litigate. Were they reasonably prepared to enter the market? Would they have entered the market under circumstances X, Y, and Z? You may have a very good position, but again, I don't see how that can be decided on the face of the complaint.
Your Honor, in the pharmaceutical industry, the way that generic manufacturers put themselves in a position to become actual competitors as opposed to potential competitors is they must file abbreviated new drug applications.
Well, that's
with the
one
FDA.
Step, of course, but they also have to have manufacturing facilities. They also have to have the ability to enter the market, and as Judge Easterbrook is saying, one of your points, I'm sure, on a summary judgment motion or the like would be that this particular step, the filing of the ANDA, is critical to showing that somebody really is on the verge. Now, the district court, who addressed that point as well, said, no, it's not such a rigid, you know, no NDA, ANDA, no readiness point.
Yes, Your Honor, the district court
and
did.
You don't have any cases, I mean, it seems to me from courts of appeals that have said, but for an ANDA, the lawsuit can be dismissed. That'd be a very easy rule, but I don't know.
If the argument were they actually have to have filed the ANDA, then on your view, if they had sent a messenger with an ANDA and Bristol-Myers had kidnapped the messenger, then they wouldn't be able to sue because, of course, they hadn't got it on file, even though it was Bristol-Myers that prevented it from being on file. Well, this isn't a case of kidnapping, but their theory, as I understand it, is that Bristol-Myers did something that, as a matter of American law, prevented them from filing such a document, or prevented the document from having any effect. It may be right or it may be wrong, but dismissing on the face of the complaint?
Well, Your Honor, there's no allegation in this complaint that says that Bristol-Myers actually prevented them from filing
the
ANDA.
They don't have to allege facts in the complaint. We do not have a fact pleading system.
But having alleged, Your Honor, that they permanently put their intention on hold in June 1997, put them in a different category from any other potential generic competitor. In fact, what we're talking about, by their own allegations here, is a small generic manufacturer.
What if they said they had abandoned their claim rather than put permanently on hold, whatever that means? I'm not sure. Did you see a distinction between abandoning it?
Your Honor, I would see that as the same thing. If they, by their choice, abandon or put it on hold, they're putting themselves into a different category from any other generic competitor or potential competitor here. We have here a plaintiff who says in their complaint that for approaching the last 15 years, they have been interested in pursuing paclitaxel as a product. And for that entire 15-year period, according to their allegations, they have never filed an ANDA. That is the one thing that a generic competitor or potential competitor must do, or they legally cannot, they have to not only have to file it, but get it approved by the FDA, or they cannot compete. They're not permitted to begin marketing. And we would respectfully submit that in a world where it takes an average of 20 months or more to get an ANDA approved, and where these folks did not even file an ANDA any time within a 15-year, almost 15-year period, and that's what you do in the industry. You get your manufacturing ready, and you write your ANDA, and you file it, and you...
Well, of course, eventually, but one can understand their allegations to include allegations that they did all sorts of things to be ready, but they didn't want to throw their money away on lawyers as long as this exclusivity period was going on for reasons utterly outside their control.
Well, Your Honor, their allegations actually are that they did certain things essentially in other countries.
I'm looking at the complaint. They also talk about other kinds of steps they took. But anyway, those are just, again, those are facts consistent with their theory, and thus they'd be able to prove whatever else is necessary, can't they?
Your Honor, they
don't say we shuttered all the plants. Well,
in fact, they don't even say that they have plants, but they say they have some contracts with some entities
right.
in some places.
That's what
but
I mean,
they,
yeah.
And they, the key point from our perspective is that they were excluded by their own admission permanently in June of 1997. That would ordinarily be an exclusionary blow struck in June 1997 by their allegation, and the statute of limitations would start running then. Their claim...
But they could only have been excluded for 30 months, given the way the Orange Book works. And their allegation is also that Bristol-Myers took additional steps at later times to maintain that exclusion.
But for their own decision not to pursue their
claim,
they would have been...
No, the plaintiff's side is...
Yes, Your Honor.
Bristol-Myers took additional steps to keep them out of the market.
They allege that there were additional steps taken by Bristol-Myers,
right.
Your Honor, but they
right.
do not
allege...
Right,
this is their allegation.
But those allegations do not make any effort to link any of the steps that Bristol-Myers took to anything that kept them out of the market. For instance, they say, well, my personal favorite is they say, oh, Bristol-Myers filed an application for combination therapy of Taxol in combination with Herceptin. They make no connection as to what that has to do with Z-Chem, and indeed it has no connection to Z-Chem at all. They make a number of allegations about suits that Bristol-Myers Squibb filed against other companies, principally IVAX, but our answer to that would be, as in Claire v. A.O. Smith, those may be alleged overt acts within the limitations period, but not anything that is alleged to have affected Z-Chem in any way. Z-Chem's own allegation is that they sat down on the sidelines in June 1997 and put their attention on permanent
hold. But one of those kinds of exclusionary practices that's really effective, which is to say using a legal structure to effectuate that exclusion. Even antitrust skeptics understand that government regulatory systems can be manipulated sometimes in a way that's very serious.
Yes, Your Honor, that's true. And they do allege that the granting of certain patents to Bristol-Myers Squibb in effect discouraged them from pursuing their ANDA. And they then, anything after that that they allege, they don't allege anything that has to do with Z-Chem. They try to say that there were some additional acts that occurred, but nothing that is said to have had any effect on Z-Chem. Per their own allegations, they say they sat down in June 1997. And our view is, respectfully, is that that is an ordinary case of exclusion, which under this court's statement in Brunswick v. Regal Tile, for example, would be subject to a 4-year statute of limitations, absent some tolling. And they have not, their own allegation establishes that commencement of the 4-year period, and they do not establish any, or even argue seriously for any tolling. With that, Your Honors, Bristol-Myers Squibb would respectfully request that the district court's opinion be affirmed. Thank you very much.
Mr. Stark. Anything further, Mr. Mattenband? If you wish to speak, please come to the podium.
I only wish to call the court's attention to the proposed amended complaint starting at Joint Appendix 238A and paragraphs 41 onward. And at paragraph 41, the offending word of permanently blocked or whatever it was the word blocked was substituted, Your Honor. And then the subsequent paragraphs of the proposed amended complaint enumerate all the affirmative acts after March of 1999 taken by Bristol-Myers. And again, back to the timeline at page 20 and 21 of the brief, it refers to specific paragraphs, to specific actions, and specific courts. Probably the most egregious was the one that occurred out in California when the sham settlement was put through the California courts. If the court has any further questions, that presentation for the appellant.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement. Our next